Welcome to the Teachers on Fire podcast, where 21st century educators come to share, learn, and be inspired. We believe in the growth mindset, creativity, communication, critical thinking, collaboration, and strategic uses of education technology. Our mission is to share news and views from teachers who are crushing it in the classroom and making a difference for learners everywhere. I'm your host, Tim Cavey. Let's jump into today's episode. Today I'm speaking with David McFarland. David is a high school IB humanities teacher at Pacific Academy in Surrey, BC, Canada. David, thanks so much for coming on the show today. Are you ready to talk education?
Deep in summer, I'm ready to go, yes.
Sounds good. Why don't you start us off by telling us about your current teaching situation?
Yeah, so I teach at Pacific Academy, which is a K-12 independent school. It's a Christian school in Surrey, which is a big suburb of Vancouver, and I'm in the high school. So I teach mostly grade 11 and grade 12, the senior high, but my teaching assignment covers grade 9 through 12, which I love, sort of seeing that spread.
Awesome. So David, we're going to start out with a low moment in your career, and this is always provides some interesting insights, I think, into sort of where you're coming from. So tell us about a low moment that you faced and then how you worked through that.
So very early on, when I came to Pacific Academy, or we call it PA, I'd moved cross country. I trained in Ontario, so a different system, and I was in public schools and then coming to independent and to a Christian school. I was just really needed to learn the culture of a school. I think that happens anywhere. You just, you know, you land somewhere new right. And what's the culture like? So I had and this was, you know, my second teaching assignment, a relatively new teacher. And I remember showing up at Pacific Academy and I'd spent sort of the summer transferring all of my thinking over and thinking, okay, I gotta match up the lingo and learn all the terminology here in BC. And then I just launched in. My first class I was teaching was a grade 9 English class.
Okay.
And I jumped in, right? And I mean, I was doing the stuff you're supposed to be doing and all the pedagogy, and I had my syllabus and was doing the thing. It was probably the third or fourth day in, and I'm just going to town, like, and I'm thinking, yeah, I'm teaching these amazing lessons. Yeah. And a student, who she's an alum of our school now, and we keep in touch, and it's hilarious, we laugh about this every time, is she just sort of blurted out in the middle of whatever instructions I was giving or guiding the class to something, and she was kind of exacerbated. She just said, we don't even know you. We don't even know who you are. Just like, she couldn't contain herself. And it sort of stopped me just in my tracks. And this phrase, we don't even know you. And it took me a little while to process that, to realize the relational component of teaching. Mm-hmm. I knew about that, like, in theory, but I realized it caught me in that moment. That was, it's a teachable moment for myself. I learned from that, but it was kind of low to realize that I was I was plowing ahead without the relational component.
Hmm. I love that story, David, and thanks for sharing it. I think that's probably the first time I've come across that particular experience, let's say, along my podcast journey here. So let's dig into that just a little bit further. I mean, I think every teacher wrestles with that on some level. What are your thoughts on, you know, how much do we share with our students? We do have to build that relationship. We need to be a little bit transparent about who we are. We have to be human, right? So what are your thoughts on where that line appears?
Yeah, that the idea of the line of being open, being transparent, but it's also context specific. Right. I mean, certainly age appropriate. Right. We've had a number of conversations I have with some of my colleagues, just about that balance of, I mean, err on the side of being personable and relatable, and but also, you know, I mean, protecting your own private life, and certainly being appropriate. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a give and take. Mm-hmm. I think it happens over time. Sort of, it's just like diving into a new class. I'm thinking about, I know some of the students I'm going to be meeting a month from now. And I know of them, I know a little bit, I've met some of them, but it's something that's going to be organic and it's going to gel a little bit. I can think of just one example when I was in the middle of, so IB history, which is, you know, sort of this academic, and I'm doing kind of, I was doing a bit of a university lecture style, which is not what I always do, but was in the middle of this. And I realized there was this natural segue for me to sort of, to break from sort of the technical stuff I was talking about, the historical thinking, and give a personal anecdote about what we were talking about. And it wasn't in my notes. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like that was something that, and it was probably about 6 weeks into the course. And it was after a bit of time of developing relationship with the students, and students start to know who I am. And that was a very natural thing. I'm not saying, you know, we get it perfect every time, but you're aiming for that pitch, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well put. David, what is it that excites you about education today? This might be a big picture kind of idea, like our new curriculum here in British Columbia, or it might be a micro level answer, something happening right there at the classroom level.
This might sound a little cliche or cheesy to say. Sure. The new curriculum, I am on the whole, I tilt towards being excited about it.
Yeah,
and I know there's lots of challenges, and I will probably talk a little later about some of the voices I'm listening to and in this conversation. But I do err on the side of being for it. The possibilities of customizing the courses to a certain extent, we've played around a lot with that in social studies in particular. It's cliched to talk about teaching students how to think critically. Navigating knowledge rather than just, you know, dumping content on them. But I think the part for me that that excites me about it is navigating a world with students that is now entirely digital in a sense. And why that excites me is that even at 34, I feel like I'm becoming a bit of a dinosaur, and that's okay. Yeah. In the sense that I remember I was in that transition generation from sort of analog to digital. Right. And I sort of had my foot in both worlds. And for these students, the internet is like electricity. It's always been there and you just flip and it's on. And I think navigating that with the curriculum shift towards thinking critically and things like media literacy, that type of thing, really, really excite me. And yet, when I mentioned feeling a little bit like a dinosaur, I become an advocate for paper books, right? And paper, reading things on paper. I always read this one thing with students, and I try and do this hybrid because everything's digital, and then we'll go to a text that's on paper. And I remember there was an article I read. I cannot quite recall who said it. This is not my phrase, but talk about students. In order for us to have fully living minds, we do need some dead trees. And talking about the dead tree edition. So I try and have a little bit of this hybrid, but that's all within some of the new directions that I know education's going in BC. And I think the customizing part of it is what excites me so much. You know, those big ideas, but then what does that look like, sort of the contours of that on the ground in a specific context?
I like the dead trees quote, David, and it makes me think, on the one hand, we've seen the studies and the articles coming out that tell us that sometimes information or content is absorbed more deeply when students or readers in general have a chance to sort of handle something in a tactile way. I'm sure you've seen some of those articles as well. But and then on the personal side, I've actually finally made the transition over the Kindle. And I'll ask you in a second if you're it sounds like maybe you're still a holdout. But you know what did it for me was, number one, just the portability when I'm traveling, just to have all my books in this one, you know, low blue light or no blue light kind of a surface. And then the other thing is that I'm a highlighter and I love to pick out those key thoughts. And when I discovered that my Kindle will allow me to do that and save all the highlights in the cloud, I was finally sold. But Yeah, I still love the physical book. So where are you personally, David? Can I ask where you're at with that?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a hybrid. For my long reads, I'm almost exclusively paper. I'm still sure. Old school with the physical book. Yeah. And I think there'll always be a place for that. But I do consume a lot of content online. I don't have a Kindle, but through either a phone or on a screen. I mean, things that are current and articles. I mean, just reading those mm-hmm. constantly and having mm-hmm. sort of the current element of that. I know one of the things that I've done with students, and this is the thing when you have a big academic course like history.
Yeah.
You want to read alongside your students. And so a lot of the stuff that I would, I don't print out everything for students, but I make it all available, mm-hmm. you know, PDF and do it all online. And I'd see students, some of them print, mm-hmm. some of them have it on their screen in front of them in the classroom. And so I'll do that too. Like I'll be reading or pull stuff mm-hmm. up on screen. So I try and balance it. But this summer has been, I mean, I've, with the exception of, you know, the Twitter feed, my reading happens on paper.
All right. Fair enough. Nothing quite beats a paperback at the beach, right? So
there you go.
David, we call ourselves lifelong learners. We're constantly curious and continue to learn personally. Hopefully that's the mark of a good educator. So tell us about another area of passion learning for you outside of the classroom. What are you into and what fuels your fire?
So this summer we kind of swap roles a bit. Both my wife and I work through the year, but of course having a bit of time off, I switch over and do a lot more cooking than I normally do. And it's not just drudgery, but I do enjoy learning some new recipes and things like that. So connecting back to technology, I've been burning through the New York Times cooking app a little bit.
Okay.
And yeah, playing around with that. So I think having the time to do that rather than sort of this, not the 30-minute midweek panic for what we're going to eat, but playing around right with different cuisines and different flavors, that kind of stuff. So I know my family appreciates that as a habit or as a hobby, sorry, you know, as opposed to something else. There's always a product at the end here that we can eat. So things like grilling, been you know, smoking a few things and meats and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So lots of fun when you have the afternoon to play around with that.
Well, very cool. I hat off to you and much respect. I'm not quite there myself, but I know I need to move a little further in that direction. So I'll come to you for advice, David, if I need any. Next, David, share about a personal habit that contributes to your success. As teachers and professionals, we have our little systems and routines. What's something that you do on the daily that really helps, let's say, make you tick?
Mm. Okay, a couple quick things. One, good coffee. I grind beans at home. I grind with colleagues. We grind beans at school. So there's the ritual component. I mean, okay. I could go on about good coffee, but I think there's the relational component. I'll take the extra time to make a good cup of coffee, and it really, that's the social bond with, whether it's talking with my wife in the morning or talking with colleagues before we head off to the classroom, that type of thing. So having a ritual that is relational. The other thing I do, connected back to reading, is I try and take probably, well, it wouldn't be a whole prep block in a day, one of them a week, but I'll try and schedule in a time. This is during the academic year where I'm reading something that is beyond the bounds of, say, my course or what I need to be reading for my students or reading student work or for the marking or whatever, is actually having a few different books, that kind of thing, on the go. Sometimes we try to have a book club or book study or whatever, but I do it on my own. I'll build that into my week and actually do it at my desk or have it at the school. And it's part of my own professional growth is to stay, it's not just about staying current, but it's staying sort of tuned in you know, to what's going on. So that's a habit that I try. I don't apologize for. I've had a couple, you know, colleagues walk in. I'm just kind of sitting there reading a book. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I have found that to be, I mean, it's a habit that is life giving, you know?
Mm-hmm. I'm such a big believer. And, you know, I haven't gotten around to ever doing that. I have seen other teachers do that. And I think there's a part of me that just needs to sort of settle down and let, you know, just put aside some of that, like you said, the never ending mountain of marking or whatever right. it might never be end. And just say, yeah, I'm going to fuel this other passion. And definitely as a lit teacher, that's, I think, a very mm-hmm. important modeling practice as well, that our students need to know that we're plugged into, you know, other types of pleasure reading. David, we're moving into some rapid fire recommendations. I know you are active on Twitter, so look forward to this next question. But tell us about someone that we need to add to our PLN on Twitter.
So if it were one person to add, I highly advocate Glenn Thielman. He's a social studies teacher out of Prince George. And he is like hyperactive online and blogging and, you know, offering a lot of his course material, but he reflects on practice beyond just if you're a social studies teacher. It's fascinating to see what he's doing in a very particular local context. Mm-hmm. And, he's a guy I highly recommend. He's a huge, huge advocate of the shift over to the new curriculum as well.
Very cool. All right. And just before we continue, I'll make sure to get all of these links and Twitter handles and whatnot onto the show notes there at teachersonfire.net. So if you are listening and you want to plug these people in and follow along with David's recommendations, you can look them all up there at teachersonfire.net. Next, David, point us to an ed tech tool that you currently love using in your classroom or your day-to-day work.
Might sound kind of basic, but the Google Classroom tool that we use, well, I use it daily. Right. We kind of Google-fied our school a couple years ago. And, you know, you got early adopters, you got this and that, the other thing. I started using it every day as just to augment what's going on in my classroom. And I mm-hmm. post every day. I've gotten into the habit of it only takes, you know, 15 minutes of my time mm-hmm. every day. Every link, every article, everything on there. I have found it to be as a tool to bring efficiency to my day. Of navigating students who are, and it's very common in high school context, you've got students away for legitimate reasons, illegitimate reasons, whatever, they're absent, go to the news feed, right? The timeline of my classroom. And then when it comes to sort of those summative moments of it's time for students to go back, they have the same timeline and they can scroll back through. Mm-hmm. So you create this log. I've done that for a couple of years now. The biggest feedback I've gotten as well is not just from parents, but actually our learning support staff. They're on there too, and they absolutely love it because it's anybody who needs to be tuned into, you know, beyond the four walls of my classroom. They get that, they have that portal into it. So use it all the time, every day.
Well, I love that pitch and I understand what you mean by, you know, the basic tool, but man, Google Classroom is a fantastic LMS. And I know there are others that are good as well. But the other day I was asked about my communication with parents and I thought back over the last year. And at first I thought, I'm not sure I did such a great job. And then I remembered that, you know, I'm logging just like you. I'm logging absolutely every move on Google Classroom and parents get these daily summaries of what's happening in our classes. And I thought, oh, you know what? Actually, my parents, I think, got a very clear sense of what was going on in my classes. So
if they want to be tuned in, it's there, right? If you provide it.
100%. Yeah. And then you're right with the SEAs and our support team in our classes working with students who have a special needs designation or what have you. I think that's a tremendous resource for them. Now, quick question on that, David. Do you add your SEAs as, do you invite them as a teacher or do you invite them as a student?
Originally, they would get the classroom code or whatever, and then they'd sign up. But then they become a student, which was a bit problematic. So it's like multiple teachers on a course. And so whether you're with our, EAs or even team teaching, right? Like I was out of the classroom for a number of days in June. But when I had a colleague was covering for me, just added her as the teacher. And then she was getting caught up on what was going on. So yeah, absolutely. The more the merrier with the teachers. Now that does give, you can't get super granular with Google and sort of have administrative and your marks and that kind of stuff. So you gotta be careful there, but.
Yeah, I found, you know, if you add an assistant or a support, we call them special education assistants. If you add them as students, then it looks like you always have one or two assignments that have not been submitted and you sort of have that problem happening. So I'm just curious to hear how other teachers are managing that. So it sounds like your solution is pretty close to mine. We're moving into books, David. Now you're an English lit teacher. You must have a long list of favorites, but is there one maybe that you've been reading lately this summer or maybe an all-time fave that you'd like to recommend for us?
Yeah, this was tricky to pick just one book. One that came out a couple of years ago that I've used just across my different courses that I teach is it's not exactly an education book, but in a way it is. James K.A. Smith, philosopher educator, wrote a book called You Are What You Love, The Spiritual Power of Habit. And he goes into sort of a bit of an anthropology of who we are as humans. And his assertion is, it's actually an ancient assertion from the likes of guys like Augustine, who would say we're not primarily thinking or cognitive beings, so much, not primarily, as we are affective, or to use an English word, we're lovers. What do we love? And we're drawn to some orientation of the good and what we love. And we're actually, as humans and as people, we are shaped by objects of our affection. And so that doesn't have to be a deity or something like that, but in a sense it's what is it that is our passion and drives us. And so he goes into that in a lot of ways, and actually he uses a religious word, liturgy, which, you know, like practices. And he actually speaks of he would call them secular liturgies. So every culture, every place has this set of practices that actually shapes who we are. And sometimes it's done consciously. Oftentimes these are unconscious things that are happening to us. It's an accessible, but it's sort of user-friendly. Like it's not, some of the stuff I read with James Smith can be very, very academic. This volume is like accessible in the sense of I get what he's saying and I can see the application, especially in education. So I talk about that with students, get them to think about that in whether it's a social studies class, whether it's, you know, in my academic history class, what have you. So I've even used sort of the intro from that with students.
Yeah, I really appreciate Jamie Smith as well. And you're right, he can certainly wax esoteric and cerebral if he wants to. He has that capacity, but yeah, he's got a lot of really practical insights as well.
This one feels grounded, yeah.
David, are you a podcast listener? And if you are, tell us about a podcast that you're enjoying and one that we should add to our podcast deck.
So I'm skewing a little bit towards history here, but there's a whole bunch of conversations. There's a historian down at university in the U.S. called named John Fea, F-E-A, okay. And he has this podcast called The Way of Improvement Leads Home, which is a weird title, but it comes from sort of the revival era in the United States. He writes and then podcasts about history, historical thinking, the role of religion in society, which is a hot button topic, certainly in his context in the U.S. Talks a little bit about baseball and also it's sort of a mixed bag of things. But it is, he's doing it as an educator. He's doing it, he's a professor of history, but the college that he's at, their history department seems to be really linked with their education program. And so some of the insights that he's bringing to, I mean, what I do in social studies and in history is historical thinking. And that's completely embedded in our new BC curriculum. John Fia would have no, you know, no connection to BC curriculum, but I see, whenever I listen to it, it's like, oh, there's the overlap all the time. So yeah, it's an interesting little podcast that that they put out. I think there's about 4 or 5 seasons now.
All right, I look forward to checking that out. Sounds fascinating. Two more questions, David. They both relate to video in some way. I know everyone uses YouTube a little bit differently. Some people subscribe to channels, other people just sort of type in whatever it is that they're searching for. But tell us, if you are a subscriber, is there a channel out there that you really enjoy? And this one, it could be one that you use in your classroom practice, or maybe one that you just find personally amusing.
This one's both, both amusing, and I use it in my classroom. John Green's Crash Courses, and the history ones in particular. But I don't just you know, hit play and, you know, see at the end kind of thing.
Yeah.
They are these massive prompts for a hook into a topic, because we can deconstruct them. I think John Green himself would want the type of things he's introducing students to thinking about, or sort of the historiography of perspective taking, etc. So the crash courses are like they're rapid fire. Like, it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose. He goes so fast. But then I'll usually have students have to respond to that in some way, right? And sort of interact with them. So, and I watch them for fun too. They're just hilarious.
He's phenomenal. Love that channel. So I'm going to second that, vote for Crash Course. And you're right, he presents the stuff, the information, the ideas in an entertaining way, with a lot of, I think, astute insights. And he also has some critical questions. So I think he's got a video on the Renaissance, for example, that, if I've got this right, he sort of asked the question, was there even a Renaissance, or is that something we've kind of fabricated? So he does do a good job of sort of deconstructing some of the narratives in history. Really appreciate his work. And then last question on the list, David, you're at the end of your day. You've got no energy left for reading or marking or anything else productive. What is it that you're watching on Netflix these days?
So with the summer season, I'm working my way back from the beginning through the end of The Office, all the reruns. And true confession, I've not actually seen the end, so don't ruin it for me. Yeah, we're deep in season 5 right now, and we just keep going through it. So you scroll through Netflix, it's like, what should I watch? That's what I'm doing. When that's done, though, I've got to go back and get primed for the new season of Better Call Saul, which is out. So really excited about that. But we got to deal with Michael and Dwight first.
Well, I think that series has gotten the most votes of the educators I've pulled so far. And yeah, I've been through it a few times. And man, is it ever good for a laugh some nights. So on those days when you've really got nothing left, or you just need a good laugh, it's a great place to go. David, this has been so much fun. For people who are interested in more of your thoughts and more of your content, what are the best ways for them to follow you online?
So I'm on Twitter, and that would be the best way to do it. You'll link it up at Mr. McF Teaches, and that's where I kind of put all my thoughts, academic, teaching, theological, what have you. It's all on there.
All in one place. All right, David. Well, this has been so much fun. It's been a pleasure to get to know you a little bit better. And I just wish you a great month of August. Hope you get fully charged up, enjoy some great family time, and come back in the fall ready to go.
Awesome. You as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Teachers on Fire, where teachers come to share, learn, and be inspired. Please subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review on iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at Teachers on Fire. I'm your host, Tim Cavey, saying goodbye for now, and we'll catch you next time right here on the Teachers on Fire podcast.